Welcome to another edition of the Membership World podcast. My name is Gordon Glenister, and I'm the founder of Membership World. This edition is sponsored by our friends at RD Mobile, the complete membership events engagement platform. But before we get started, please don't forget to subscribe to this podcast just to make sure that you don't miss a future episode. Now, in today's episode, I'm talking with Simon Goldie, who's the Director of Advocacy at the Finance and Leasing Association. Naturally, we're talking all about advocacy and why it's important for associations. And here's what Simon had to say.
My background is broadly communications, I'd say. I spent about 15 years in the world of market research, and that was B2B research on issues like marketing. I see you've got influencer marketing strategy behind you. So we would have done a lot of work looking at marketing to certain sectors or certain types of marketing, its effectiveness, advertising, general comms, business strategy, and so on. And there were some things slightly outside that, but that was broadly what I was doing for that time. And near the end of my time in market research, I began doing PR and then jumped over to the first membership body I worked for doing PR and lobbying. And that, I suppose, is really where the journey of advocacy began. Since then, I've been in three membership bodies, including the FLA. I've spent a bit of time with LexisNexis doing work on stakeholder engagement, thought leadership and media, and some other things in between. So I've got a mixed toolkit that I can open up and pull out various things I've done over the years. And they come together at the FLA in a slightly different way to the way that I'd done it in other roles.
Super. Great background there. So tell us a little bit more about your job. Why is it so important for associations to be leaders and experts in their field?
Membership bodies are driven by their members and their members' needs. So it's important, first of all, to understand exactly what your members want and then obviously to deliver it. Otherwise, you're not going to succeed. Broadly speaking, most membership bodies or most members of membership bodies want two things. They either want services that they can't access in another way. And those services can cover a whole range of different areas. So for us at the FLA, we do provide a lot of industry stats, and that's actually key for members to help them understand what's going on in their market and to plan ahead. And then the other side is what would be called advocacy. So, you know, being a voice for members to government, to regulators, to opposition. And at the FLA, we do both. So some organizations have more of an emphasis on the service and some more on the lobbying. My role is not just about helping us communicate outwards to those important institutions, but also to be an advocate for what the members do. So what they do and their contribution to the economy. And that's to work with other stakeholders, other bodies that represent members' customers. So it's a slightly different role to how some advocacy jobs would go. We also have a director of communications and a director of government affairs. So they are focused obviously on those two areas. And mine's a broader one around coordinating what we're doing and ensuring that we are leading by example and showing the worth of the members. Why is it important? Well, because the members want it and they require it. I mean, particularly, we're split into three areas at the FLA. We have consumer, motor, and asset finance. I began looking after the asset finance members and still do, as well as having the advocacy role. And asset finance in particular is a little bit misunderstood. The phrase is used to mean different things by different people. There are variations on the phrase. So it's very important to make sure that when you're talking to a government minister, that they know you're talking about what our members do and not what somebody else does. So that's kind of key to ensuring that. And also when we're talking to other representative bodies, to help them communicate to their members the value of what our members can bring, if they so choose to use asset finance. They may not, and that's fine, but it is very important. So a large part of the work has been working with SMEs on access to finance issues, which you wouldn't necessarily think is what the Finance and Leasing Association would do. You might think it's more the FSB, British Business Bank and others, and they do, and we work with them on that. But what I've done, I spent a lot of time on that, but for all those reasons.
Something you just mentioned there, which is quite interesting, you mentioned the FSB and you mentioned other organizations. I guess one of the biggest challenges that so many associations have is they're not always the only association in that particular market. So having one single voice on a key subject matter, it can be quite challenging, can't it? I guess if it's something around access to finance, as many of you talking about the key principles of this is very important. Otherwise, you've got a challenge with, well, they're saying something over here and they're saying something over there. And how do we really know what the true message is and communication?
But you're absolutely right. And this was brought home to me many years ago. And so the first membership body I joined, which was the Chartered Institute of Taxation, and we'd gone in, I'd taken two members to see the Paymaster General, as I think actually the job title's still around, but it's not used as much now. But it was Dawn Primorolo. She was in charge of tax. And we were there to talk about tax simplification. That was a big key thing for CIOT members, to try and make the system work better for taxpayers. And she listened to everything and she said, look, you know, I get it. I understand why it's important for you and for other professional bodies in this world. But every time we try and put a simplification measure in, we get business bodies coming and saying, well, you know, that's going to really damage the business model of our members because they've worked towards whatever the tax arrangement was previously. So please don't do it. So she said, so we're, you know, it's kind of a rock and a hard place for policymakers. I was pretty new to all that world at that point. And I thought, yeah, we need to deal with this. And from then on, and when I was at CIT and since, I've always made a point of building relationships with other representative bodies, working with them, and trying to be as aligned as we possibly can be. You can't always agree on everything, or you have a nuance about how you like something done. Access to finance actually is relatively easy one. Well, it's not relatively easy to get the finance all the time, but it's relatively easy as an issue because we are in agreement with the FSB and others on the kind of challenge that smaller businesses face. And it's largely about an information gap. So our members have an appetite to lend. The liquidity is there. The real issue is finding the businesses to lend to, and the businesses being what we're calling match fit for finance. So actually, when they come and apply, they've done everything they need to do to get that finance. That's been a relatively easy topic to agree on and pursue policies on and talk to government about. You know, it's not easy on every single thing, but I think we all recognize that if we can align as much as possible so that when we go in and we have these conversations or we put in our budget submissions, we're saying similar things, it is much easier to get what you're asking for. And it makes it easier for government because they're kind of not thinking, well, you know, as you were saying, A is saying this and B is saying that, and what do we do? I mean, another example has been around full expensing. So we had the super deduction a few years ago, and we and seven other bodies were lobbying to include leasing in the super deduction. It wasn't, it was excluded. It passed. We've now got full expensing. And so we're making the same argument. And again, we've been sort of lockstep in why it needs to be included and how you could do it to make it work for both all our members and for the government. So absolutely key. And I would say anybody starting out or doing these sort of jobs, you really should talk to other representative bodies that interact in your ecosystem. It's not necessarily your rivals, but it's others as well that your members, customers are interacting with. Bring them together and find a consensus. And it makes life much easier and much more powerful when you're presenting to politicians.
Yeah, no, absolutely agree with you. I mean, what about when some would say that are not members? I think the FLA are great. You know, I let them carry on doing these amazing things that affect our industry. Why do I need to belong to them to have that benefit of lobbying?
We have most of the asset finance businesses in membership. So we have overcome that problem largely. There are some out there who aren't. They're mostly very small players and they feel they won't get as much benefit from being a member. And I understand that. Obviously, we'd love to have them in. But why they should join is because when you become a member, you get a voice in the organization. So you help shape policy, you feed in to what we're doing. And without that, you know, we could come up with something that isn't necessarily going to work for you because your business model is a little bit different to all the other members. And we wouldn't be aware of that. The other side of it is that we also spend a lot of time, and it goes back to my point about the services provided. We spend a lot of time helping members navigate through the legislative, regulatory landscape that is out there. And so we're not proactively doing anything to government on that bit. What we're doing is saying, look, this is what's coming down the road, or this is what's there, and this is the way to deal with it. Now, that also feeds into then what we say to government, because members may say, well, that's a real problem over here. It would be much more helpful if it was done this way. And then we would take that and have a conversation and see where we get. But if you're a member of the FLA and it's a voluntary association, you know, you don't have to be a member to be a provider of asset finance. But if you are a member, you get the benefit of feeding in to that community and you get to understand the issues that everybody else is facing and get, you know, our briefings, our guidance and so on.
And when you say feeding in, do you mean through surveys that you run with members, or do you mean through forums or discussion groups or all of the above?
It is all of the above. And I think it has to be. So like most membership bodies, we do an annual survey of the members to take their temperature in terms of how they think we're doing and how they're doing, what their issues they're facing. We have a plethora of committees and forums to discuss industry issues and policy issues. And as well as that, I go and talk to members on a one-to-one basis. So I either go and see them face-to-face, which is a bit radical these days, or we do this because on a one-to-one basis, you can have a slightly different conversation to a committee meeting.
Yeah, and sometimes people don't always want to share, particularly if things are difficult, they don't necessarily want to share warts and all, do they, where they might give you more information on a one-to-one basis.
But also on sort of competition rules and confidentiality, there's certain things that can be discussed that you can't discuss in a committee. And it's just also the nature of a committee doesn't always lead to those conversations. So I try and make sure that I'm engaging on a whole different raft of levels to understand members' needs, how they see an issue and what they want from us. Generally, actually, there's pretty much broad agreement on those things. There are different perspectives. I mean, we have banks in membership and we have non-banks. We have finance arms of manufacturers. We have what we call vendor finance providers. So they do partnerships with suppliers and manufacturers. And they'll all have a slightly different perspective on certain issues just by the nature of how they're set up and what they do. They'll also agree on lots of other things.
I mean, so how do you measure efficacy in your eyes?
Well, that is very difficult, I have to say. It's obviously much easier to measure, you know, numbers through a door for a conference. But we try and get some hard measurement, but also we have to say, look, this is what we're wanting to achieve. And we then get judged by the results. You could do it one way and say, I will meet with 20 civil servants this year. And you could go and meet with those 20 civil servants and get nowhere. And actually, by having that objective, that target, you then focus on that target and slightly forget what you're trying to achieve. You just got to make sure you have those meetings. I think one has to kind of have a combination of the two. Obviously, it is important to try and measure what you're doing, but you also have to acknowledge that you are wanting to influence and engage. You are either shaping future policy or mitigating a policy that is perhaps having an adverse effect. I worked in an engineering body about 10, 11 years ago now, and we were arguing for an infrastructure bank. And it wasn't just us, it was other bodies as well. And we did papers, you know, we had a lot of meetings. Fast forward 10 years later, we've now got one. And that's the challenge of trying to measure what you're doing. I have no doubt that the work we started led to it, but it had to be carried on. The argument had to be kept being made and discussions kept being had about why it was a good idea, what potentially were the downsides and how you deal with them and so on. You have to kind of view, well, what is the policy objective you're trying to achieve? How might you achieve it? How can you measure it?
I was just going to ask you this. I belong to a private members club, actually. It's called the One Club, and it's all about an impact statement. And one of the things that really caught my attention was they were very focused on the vision and the purpose of what they wanted to achieve. They wanted their member to come along with them. And I really liked it, actually, because they were sharing the bigger picture of the vision. So it wasn't just like, and I've seen in some associations, it's almost like there's two sides to the coin. This is what the association does, and that's what the members do, and never the twain shall meet. It's you go and do your thing, and we'll measure you accordingly, rather than saying, come with us together on this journey of change. Advocacy, I guess, isn't just about through government. It's also about the members advocating what you guys are doing as well to their own communities. So I was going to ask you about that.
We revamped our purpose about 4 years ago. Now, actually, I'm not sure if we had a purpose. We might have a vision and mission. I can't remember. But you're correct in that you have to be aligned with your members. The members and you are really, it's the same organization. It shouldn't be separate. I think fundamentally, membership bodies are there to help members do their job, which you could say then is your purpose. But then what you have to say is, well, how do you do that? And then that goes back to my opening remarks about services and being a voice. And that then is, what are the members wanting to achieve? How can you help them achieve it? So our purpose talks about a sustainable financial kind of ecosystem landscape. And that's what they want. Our role is to sort of work out how can we contribute to that and help them achieve it, as opposed to just delivering a service for them, let us say. And then you're absolutely right again, that if you can get that connection, they will be advocates for you, and they will then sort of suggest people join when they are having their own conversations with government or regulators or other stakeholders. They will talk about you in a positive way, as we do about them. So it's a two-way process. It doesn't work if it isn't.
No. But unfortunately, there are some associations that you hear these stories about, or I hear feedback from members, and they say the only time our association calls us is when they want the renewal invoice, you know, unless we come to some of their events. And I think it's great that the FLA have got a role like yours, which is clear and distinctive about what you as an organization are trying to do, and to bring the members along with you and to engage with them. Because for me, one of the measurements is if people are advocating for you as members, proud to be members, displaying their logos everywhere, those are good measurements criteria, if I'm honest, as to how they feel about the organization and what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. If I can go back again to my days at the Chartered Institute of Taxation, nobody really knew what a chartered tax advisor was, which is how you recognize a CIOT member, whereas you know what a chartered accountant is. And so we were doing quite a bit of work to promote that term and get people to understand it. I happened to be on a bus heading home on a Saturday night. It was quite crowded, got chatting to a couple of blokes on the bus. And I said, "Oh, well, what do you do?" And he said, "I'm a tax advisor." I said, "All right, well, you remember the CIT?" He said, "Oh, yeah." And he was in his probably early 20s, I think. And I said, "Oh, well, I work for them." And we never met. And there was a real disconnect between the organization and him. He'd done the qualification. He'd got the letters after his name and hadn't really engaged. And that made me think we need to do a bit more on this as well. We need to think about how do we bring people in once they've gone through the exam and not just sort of let them drift off because of all the things you've just said.
Yeah. You know, if you look at why people join organizations and stay, a sense of belonging comes up very, very high on the list of reasons. They want to feel connected to a community. And that doesn't mean to say that they always respond to emails or newsletters. Sometimes I hear from associations, "Oh, well, we've emailed our members and they don't come to events. They don't." So I say, "Well, have you thought about picking the phone up? Have you thought about creating a mini advocacy program where you've got representatives of groups of regional ambassadors or something like that, which allows them to connect on a more local level?" I remember when I was running the BPMA and we welcomed members in to the organization, I would automatically send a welcome email myself to them, but also copy in the local regional ambassador. And that meant that it wasn't just London centric. It was, we had somebody on the ground in Scotland that was also able to welcome them to a local event. Because I think in this day of attention economy, it's really difficult, isn't it, to keep in touch. But I don't know how many members you have, but it can be quite difficult. But breaking down groups of people, and I love the fact that you've got special interest groups, because that's another great vehicle for creating advocacy, because then you've got a niche within a niche, haven't you?
You're absolutely right. I mean, the reason I told that story is because it made me realize there's a danger of disconnect, and you need to address that disconnect. And there's a danger of thinking, "Oh, we're doing a really good job and, you know, the survey results are okay," and not making much of an effort. But you've got to build a relationship. The work you put into building a relationship with the external stakeholders, you have to do the same with your membership and find different ways to do it that works for the members. Because not everything, as you said, you know, you get an email, some people will respond, some people won't. So you've got to, and actually the more you build a relationship, the more they will respond to the email.
Exactly.
If the relationship's
right.
Not there, they'll ignore you. So all of that has fed into the work I've done at the FLA to build up that relationship. And to answer your question about how many members we have, I mean, that we're a trade association, so we're not a professional body. So our members are businesses, not people. Now, obviously, it's the people who come along. So we've got over 200 businesses who are members, but within those businesses, we've got, you know, thousands of people who could engage. And so then you've got to work out, well, who should we be talking to and how can we effectively talk to as many as possible? And one of the other dangers or challenges that one has is you could build a very, very good relationship with one or two people, but that's all. And then if they move on, you've lost your member because nobody else really knows what you're doing or why you're doing it. So one of the things that I did early on at the FLA was start to not just talk to the key people on our list, but to say to them, can I come in and see your teams and just tell them what the FLA is about, what we do, and hear from them what they want from us or what they're seeing in their market? What are their big issues? What are the pain points, to use that kind of cliched phrase? That really helps, because those people either stay in those firms and become senior leaders, and so you want to engage them, or they move somewhere else and do the same. So it's very much stakeholder relationships, building those relationships, nurturing them, fostering them.
Yeah, it's so important, so important. And you can't just rely on one main contact. And also there could be different services. I don't know if you have an educational division within your business, but, you know, so often that might be something that the main contact may not want or need. But actually, there might be other people in there that, given the chance, would say, yeah, I'd love to be involved in that. So, you know, you never know, really.
Yeah, to answer your question, we do training. We have a diploma in asset finance. We don't have an education team per se, but we do have a service that provides that. Because again, we're not a professional body, we're a trade association. And it's a slightly different thing when you're a trade association to do those things. And yes, some people, I mean, early on in their career, they want training. Although having said that, we did have somebody who'd been in asset finance all his career and decided to do the diploma. And I thought, well, he probably could write it. But he just wanted to do it to say he had the diploma. He passed and did well. So
There you go. Great. Well, look, Simon, it's been lovely talking to you today. And thanks for really sharing some light on what you do at the FLA and how important advocacy is, both at a policy level and at sort of a member level. I wish you all the very best for the future. How can people find out more about you and the FLA if they want to?
Well, we have a website, as most people do, so www.fla.org.uk. And there's some information about me on there, some blogs I do, and we do our own podcast as well. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter. Simon Goldie on LinkedIn and on Twitter. You can find me there too.
This podcast is sponsored by RD Mobile, providing events and member engagement solutions used by organizations worldwide. RD Mobile can help your organization deliver value at your next virtual or in-person event and throughout the year. Visit us at rdmobile.com to learn more.
That's it for another edition of the Membership World podcast. Thanks again to our sponsor, RD Mobile, and my producer, Neil Whiteside from Freedom One. And until next time, from me, Gordon Glenister, it's bye for now.